All right, cool. So yeah, this is our first time going without Tony.
Bear with us.
Not that he's off the show or anything, but he's on vacation or something. We occasionally let him out of the dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so hopefully I won't mess up anything here.
Is Tony your producer?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. He's our boss.
Is he the kid that had that rad bike outside of Musica?
Probably.
He is always on a bike.
Okay.
He's got real curly hair.
Yeah, that was him.
Yeah, whenever you think you see Jack Harlow riding around, it's actually Tony.
That's a pretty sweet bike.
I was thinking I could record a bunch of like fake introductions to give him that are all terrible. Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the podcast for movies that aren't too groovy.
Oh no, that's good.
That's what I was going to give Tony. Just see the podcast where an unwatch isn't a fun watch. Okay, really? Sorry, we're never going to get started.
Bum trip.
I'm cool, man. I'm just here.
Yeah, because God like shits when he kills himself.
Oh, soundboard. We got a soundboard.
I have control of the soundboard now.
A nice dick too.
Oh my god, it's all out of context. I swear, I would never just say something so frivolous.
I'm not even sure what some of these are.
Do you imagine what his anus looks like?
I'm glad I don't have the power over the soundboard because that'd be the whole show.
It really would be, you know.
Yeah,
that's what I
need to get this all out of my system. What is
blood-soaked cum shot?
Oh. Reverb.
It's a very literary, academic podcast.
Featured on NPR. Blood Soaked Cum Shot featured on NPR.
If only, man.
Who is he? Does he fuck you better?
All right, Mark. All right. You're mad with power.
All right, sorry. I didn't know he was going to have them all. Yeah. Let's probably get to this episode. Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the podcast to help you make the cinematic decisions you can't take back. I'm Mark D'Ottavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're discussing Ralph Bakshi, one of the most influential and controversial figures in the history of animation. The films in question are his 1972 hit X-rated adaptation of R. Crumb's Fritz the Cat, and his incendiary 1975 satire Street Fight, a.k.a. Coonskin. Ooh, buddy.
Meow.
All right, we have a very special animation expert on our show today. If you'd like to introduce him, Seth.
Jared Gonzalez, local legend of Canton, Ohio.
Hello.
He's like a local pop culture expert, I feel like. You're a bit of a resource, I think. And, you know, everybody's got the internet these days. Yeah. But the real thing is running into like a real deal fan like you, like connoisseur, collector.
I don't know about all that. I think I'm just a product of the late 20th century.
At two.
Yeah, a product of pre-internet fandom and obsession, I guess.
But yeah, you're more than a product. You're like something that rolled off the assembly line and
I'm a commodity.
Mutated a little bit into its own thing. You know, you're your own thing. And you make comics. You make art. Got to plug your Instagram, Cosmic Tropics? Comic Tropics?
Cosmotropics, yeah. It's mostly illustrations, watercolors, things like that. Just noodling around.
It's beautiful work.
It's American culture through a Mexican lens, I guess. It's how I view most things. Being an implant or a transplant.
I know it has like a bit of like a psychedelic kind of edge to it. It seems.
Yeah, I'm too afraid to do a lot of psychedelics, so I just let my pieces do them for me.
Right on.
I just imagine what it's like.
It seems very fitting for a, you know, Bakshi. Your stuff kind of reminds me a little bit of Bakshi. It's like,
yeah, Bakshi's also an immigrant. I think just the way that I feel about his work is the way that we both kind of like see the fucking weirdness of the American experience, because it is majorly weird, especially to outsiders. So I think that's maybe I'm just putting it through my like lens, but that's how I've always seen his work.
Totally.
Well, yeah, that's why I like having artists and people who are a little more familiar with animation and different animators on when we talk about these kind of movies, because it really is this whole other medium that my vocabulary is a little bit limited on. Although we had a really good animation episode just not too long ago where we talked about Plague Dogs and Felide, and we also benefited from having that. And I like how these movies in particular and Bakshi's whole style is really in contrast to that, even though none of these films are, you know, for children. So I do want to start talking about Ralph Bakshi, and feel free to, you know, join in with anything that you know that maybe we don't. Just from what I read about him, he did come up through like the traditional studio animation system in the late 50s and in through the 70s. Through Paramount, I believe.
Here I am to save the day. Save the day.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mighty Mouse. Yeah. He started on Mighty Mouse.
I actually don't think that he would have been the same person had he not gone through the system first. Because his whole thing, I feel, is a giant fuck you to the system. You know, like a big, massive middle finger, especially to Disney. But if he hadn't had that experience of how limiting and oppressive the animation industry was and still is, I don't think his voice would have been what it ended up being, you know?
Sure, because by the time that his first movie, Fritz the Cat, came out in 72, I mean, at that point, Disney basically owned animation, as far as I know.
Yeah, it was, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was viewed as something that was mainly for children, for families. It was not necessarily an adult art form, or, you know, there would be Hanna-Barbera shows on TV. And there really wasn't like an independent wing, like as an alternative to that. And so I think that might be his most influential thing as far as feature length animation goes, is it finally had this independent sensibility and this way to reach people that's an entirely different audience than it was aimed at before. And it was surprisingly successful at the time.
Yeah, especially like Fritz the Cat taking like what, like $700,000 and making it into $9 million. Like, I'm sure it made the right people be like, "Oh, you can do this with the dirty cartoons."
I love that shit.
Yeah, but it's crazy because like, you know, at the time, everyone just bought into, like, everyone in animation just bought into Disney's, like, to the thing, because when animation started, it was experimental. It was about anything and any subject. And it was just because everyone was just so glad to find a new way to tell stories. Or so it was like a lot of, like, you know, experimentation with live action. Like some of the first animation films or the Alice films where it's like a live actress interacting with animation. And somewhere along the way, Disney just made everyone feel like if you don't have the best recording, the best audio, the best take, the best artist, and a bunch of money, and aimed at children, it's not worth doing, and you're not going to be able to do anything for it. And that's where Bakshi came in and said, basically said, fuck that. Like, we're going to make it any way we can, and it's not just about this, and you don't need all that stuff. You don't need the best recordings. You don't need an army of people. You just need the will to make it and have something to say, which I'm very glad that, you know, I do love Disney. I'm an animation fan. I love Disney, but I'm really glad that everyone got out of that oppressive thumb, because it did. If it didn't, most of the late 20th century and early 21st century, as far as media, animation media and stuff like that, would not exist. None of it would be the same. It would just be Warner Brothers and Looney Tunes and stuff all over and over and over again. So I'm really glad for that.
Yeah, there's like this secret edge to animation that has, it's been this sort of the dark side throughout the whole history of it has kept up. It's been continually like bashed and pushed away and like kept in the shadows as time goes on, but it persists. And a lot of like, the lessons that Bakshi was fighting for are, like, in some ways only just now coming to true fruition. It feels like the idea of, like, indie sort of cheaper animation being taken seriously, smaller studios being taken seriously. It's still like an uphill battle to get anything that's a serious feature as far as cartoons or animation are concerned. It's still an uphill battle to get those made.
Well, yeah, because Disney diversified its war, and now it at first it was saying like it was using the gold standard as a barrier of entry for anyone who wanted to get into animation. And once Bakshi and other folks broke that down, then Disney said, well, now I'm just going to own all the avenues of media. And so you have to get through one of my subsidiaries to get anywhere into the public. and you know what I mean? So,
yes.
So it's a constant battle. But with technology and stuff, putting really powerful tools into people's hands, I'm really actually very hopeful for the future as far as animation, because just the way that technology has made home recordings and bedroom acts and stuff like that a big thing now, I'm really hoping that that'll happen for animation as well. And the more powerful these tools become and the more populous they become, then who knows what we're going to see. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. And I think this clearly opened the doors for the other movies we talked about that were animated, like Plague Dogs, Watership Down, When the Wind Blows, that were very adult stories. But I do think there is a difference between, you know, those were movies that really were telling, you know, had weighty dramatic stories and were just kind of treating animation as just another way that you could, you know, be artistic and tell stories that are meant, you know, for adults with those kind of themes. Whereas the way that these things kind of strike me starting out is that, you know, this is much more about specifically boundary pushing, you know, engaging with the counterculture, being naughty and explicit and transgressive. And I think in that sense, you could draw a straight line from something like Fritz the Cat through to like The Simpsons and South Park, all of the, you know, comedy animation that's out there today. And so it kind of starts in this place that's, a little bit, I mean, you could argue juvenile. I think that one of the tensions here is between maybe how much is being, you know, irreverent and boundary pushing and satirical versus kind of appealing to like, you know, here's a bunch of animals with big human tits and little human dicks and they're all fucking yeah. each other, you know.
The downfall of Bakshi.
See, I think it's all the above. That's the thing with this stuff for me. It is... The way the 70s and 60s counterculture works, it's opening of that can of worms, just like throwing everything at the wall now that we suddenly like we were so oppressed in the post-war world. And it was just so novel and so exciting to just do it all suddenly. Just like everything is up there on the screen. Like it's not just... what became more mature with age, with a lot of like things like Plague Dogs and things like that, began like this, which was just sort of really just like already like into an Adult Swim world where it's just like, can we do it? Okay, we will do it. We will like put a giant elephant on the scene where he's on acid and he's got huge tits and they explode. You know, it's just like the craziest thing we can dream up we will do.
I also think it was kind of perfect timing where this was an era where they were starting to have X-rated movies that were being released and actually making money and being marketable
mm-hmm.
In a way that would go away big time in like the 80s and 90s. And now, I guess we've kind of come back around where you could just put anything out, whether it's on network TV or YouTube. But at the time, you know, they ended up with a distributor that specialized in like exploitation films and had this grindhouse sensibility. And when Fritz the Cat, which was his very first movie, ended up getting an X rating, they were able to use that as a way to market this as you've never seen anything like this before. This is, you know, this is naughty and subversive. And ended up being one of the most successful independent films ever in a way that I think was dependent on that, you know, particular time and place.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, because like had it not been X-rated, would it have been that successful on just the own merits of the film alone? I mean, I love the animation. It's a beautiful film. There's a lot of visually great aspects of it. But would it have made that much money if it wasn't for the tantalizing X rating, you know, the advertising X rated stuff? Like probably not. I mean, in my opinion, I don't think so.
I think we need to talk about R. Crumb if we're going to talk about Fritz the Cat, because he is the one who did the original comic strip, which came out in different magazines and underground comics between 65 and 72. And it was very much, you know, a part of the kind of countercultural movement. They were very satirical, although I haven't actually read one myself, which is where I wanted to ask you guys if you have any particular, have you anyone here actually read a Felix, or I would say Felix, Fritz the Cat?
Yeah, sure. I've read Felix. I love Robert. He's one of my art heroes.
Yeah, same.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't love the person that he's become. I love who he was. We'll say that right now. But that's what's crazy is that it at the time when, I mean, so Bakshi found a copy of, I think it was Help Magazine or some, whatever, one of the things that featured Fritz. And at the he found it a little later, a little after, you know, the underground comic scene. But he basically found his direction. He's like, this is where I need to go. This is like what I need to do. But it's crazy that before that, you know, in the California scene and the, you know, comic scene, Last Gasp, all those guys, they were addressing all this stuff in comics all the time. It was basically like the prerequisite to that whole scene. It's like, oh, what are you talking about? And it's not funny animal comics. It's like counterculture comics and race relations and, drug use and homelessness and a bunch of other stuff. So it's wild that like all that stuff was going on in the counterculture movement. It was big. And then the animation was not reflecting that at all. Even there, not every animator at the time was working for Disney or Warner Brothers or Fleischer or whoever, and so it's wild that no one beat him to it, that no one said like let's do this, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And there is something so exciting about this era of like R. Crumb and Zap Comics and all these guys that I mean it totally makes sense that Ralph kind of would jive with this, or someone in Ralph's position would jive with this, because it is like, it's already a gutter medium. It's this idea of like especially back then, which like comics are getting more respect. They have more respect than they've ever had. But like in the 70s, they were still seen as just like throwaway rags. Like, and people going into comics specifically knew this, especially like alternative comic people knew this and knew it as a way of like, yeah, I might not make very much money, but like I'm going to have absolute freedom with this because no one's watching, nobody cares. So if I want to like put something absolutely batshit insane, or like maybe like, you know, politically incorrect quite often and like questioning and pushing boundaries, like I can put it in there. And the flip side is there was a lot of people that were like, if I want to put like experimental art into this, like some of the shit I learned in art school, or make my comics more literary, like I can do that, because again, it's not about like, it's not about making money really. Cause it's that once that's taken out of art, that is when things get really interesting. I think with artists, they're kind of willing to put things into it that aren't like, they're not as concerned about it making ends meet or whatever.
And I wonder how much of Crumb's rocky relationship with this movie had to do with it opening it up to a wider audience. Because, when he first met with Bakshi, it seemed like things started out well, but then he was refusing to actually sign a contract for them to be able to make the movie. And apparently his wife, for some reason, had power of attorney over him and ended up giving permission for them to make the movie. But he claimed afterwards that it did not like align with his politics and that he was not a fan of the movie. And that does make me wonder, for you guys who are more familiar with these, you know, with the original source material and with Crumb, what the difference is, you know, basically where Bakshi ends and Crumb starts with this. But maybe we could start at least with the stylistic parts about this, because I mean, the content is a whole other thing, but it definitely struck me that, you know, the way the backgrounds are done here, I believe they traced photos and use watercolor so that the backgrounds kind of had a more realistic look to them.
It's the Bakshi way.
Yeah, that's the Bakshi way. And a lot of it actually, believe it or not, comes from cost cutting, comes from not having an entire army of animators and background painters and all that stuff. It's just like, How can we get vistas and crowds and stuff like that without having to spend hours and hours on a background painting? So it was more of a cost cutting measure, I think, but it ended up becoming one of his trademarks, and it works. It's some of my favorite parts visually of Fritz or a lot of his other movies are when he is using realistic backgrounds, as in Coonskin / Street Fight, or rotoscoping, things like that. So stylistically, that's where they differ. Now, when Crumb was like on board at the beginning, slightly on board, it's because Bakshi had shown him art that was done in his style. So, I mean, animated Fritz sort of has a crummy style, sort of has like those hash lines and stuff, but not really. So I get the feeling that Bakshi kind of like, not maybe swindled him, but kind of said like, look at this, this is the direction we're going to go, kind of bait and switched him, and then, you know, knew that he couldn't pull off. Because to animate Crumb the way he draws would definitely take an army of animators to do the shading the way he does it.
Right. Yeah, because Crumb is this, on the surface, like, at first glance, he's just doing funny animal comics, like, especially with Fritz the Cat. But if you just spend a little time looking at one of those frames, one of those panels, it's the intense cross-hatching and intense attention to detail in some of those. Now, it's kind of all over the place, though. Like, his earlier Fritz the Cat, his earlier work is very just, like, punk rock. Like, looks like he did it with a ballpoint pen real fast. But other times, he is, like, being very, like, psychedelic with the way he's putting things together. And he's a total, like... There's a documentary about him that's pretty great called Crumb.
Yeah.
And as you can see through there, he's like a classic contrarian, for lack of a better word. He's also like really brilliant for sure. But I think he has a little bit of that where it is just like, if he's not totally in control of it, he doesn't like it.
He's a bit cranky.
He's a real crank.
He's an eccentric crank.
I think how he bonded with Terry Zwigoff, who made Crumb, was because they both like collected jazz records too, and that was a big part of his, you know, his tastes.
That's how he's bonding with everyone all over the place. That's how he bonded with Harvey Pekar too.
Oh yeah,
right. Yeah,
American and Splendor.
And you know, just for anyone who's listening who hasn't seen Fritz the Cat, I mean, generally this takes place in a Manhattan that is filled with anthropomorphized animals, just like our other animated films. We got, you know, cats. But we also got pigs, literal pigs, as cops running around. The black people are generally crows, which that's a whole other thing we can talk about. And but I think this whole urban milieu is something that continued through Bakshi's work, from what I can tell, and definitely in the other movie that we're going to talk about. And part of that is that he would use these documentary recordings of people talking and then animate them, which we do see throughout Fritz the Cat. It's not the whole thing isn't like that, but we get these weird little vignettes that seem to just be like regular people talking, like the way this movie opens with a bunch of construction workers kind of complaining about young people these days. And it sounds like kind of a captured conversation that's been animated.
Yeah, that's his bread and butter. I mean, that's throughout so many of his movies, is just taking real world recordings. And then I think later in later movies, he did have actors, but he just basically had them improvise. But that becomes like a trademark almost. And sometimes it seems really unrelated. It's mostly flavor. But I think if you didn't have that flavor, it most of the time it adds nothing to the narrative and really is just like a long scene setup. But I feel you would miss them if it wasn't in the movie. It wouldn't hit the same, I feel.
Yeah, especially when we're talking about various racial groups that are being represented in sometimes unflattering ways, especially from a 2022 lens. Like you said, Mark, there are black people being represented as crows in this.
Big Dumbo vibes to that.
Yes, for sure. But at the same time, there are these like very humanizing moments in the
in the scenes where, and I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but we eventually go to like a, there's like a bar like downtown that they go to. There's like a blacks only bar that Fritz goes to. And for like a full minute, it's just hearing chatter in the bar of like, and it's not like written scripted dialogue. It's just improvised dialogue. It's like Robert Altman or something like that. And it does feel like he's literally like letting them talk. He's just letting them say what they would say rather than giving them lines and things like that, which, you know, would be more problematic with from like a white director, like, this is how you talk when you're at the bar, right? Black person, you know, that kind of thing. Like,
and technically the varying levels too really add to the, like, you are in that bar crowded vibes, because it's not, no one, not everyone's mic'd up the same. Not everyone, the audio levels are all over the place. So it really does sound like some folks are quieter and louder and things like that. And that really adds to that ambiance. But if we get into the whole, like, the black experience through a Bakshi film, through Bakshi's eyes, it's like a whole, and it's another can of worms too.
Really is.
Yeah. And we'll, that'll be very prominent, I think, even more so in our discussion of Coonskin, just by the title alone. There's elements of that in this, but this does seem to be like we're getting a little more of a panorama something. This is a very episodic, not very plot-driven movie that kind of has, yes, Fritz going through various adventures with the counterculture. And a lot of it is, you know, with hippies and... Basically, the film opens with those construction workers. One of them goes and takes a piss and pisses all over a hippie. And I feel like that's kind of this movie in a nutshell, where there's a lot of kind of satirical gestures and crude comedy in different ways. But as far as coming away with this with an actual like target, it really seems to me like he's taking on these like empty-headed hippies. What we would call woke today, like one of the first scenes has these girls all talking to one of these crows, you know, saying, "Oh, I'm taking a course on African studies. I had no idea you guys were so civilized."
Yeah.
Oh
my God. Yeah, they're trying to one-up each other as far as who is more sympathetic, yes, to the plight of crows.
Yeah, like, I love the one girl. She's like, you know, isn't it so sad that James Earl Jones keeps getting typecast into playing black characters? You know, which is just like... I feel like I would run into some white girl saying that exact same thing right now with like a different actor, because it is such a problem still, like this sort of pandering, this sort of like Fritz in the movie also has like this whole like speech where he like goes off about how, like, you know, it's hard on me too, you know, like, I'm guilty. I feel so guilty about all this stuff. Boo hoo. And it's very, very much framing him as like being an idiot for like basically like going on and on about his guilt to this old black man in this movie, who doesn't give a shit about his guilt and is not going, his guilt of this college kid, not going to help him at all.
Yeah, this NYU student.
Which I think, yeah, I think a lot of it is like, yeah, it's a lot of like two steps forward, one step back, all kinds of like, it's really interesting, like ping ponging around with issues. Like sometimes it's like extremely forward, sometimes it's extremely backwards. That's kind of the Bakshi way. I like that we keep saying that.
I also feel like there's some things that Bakshi knows inside and out. Like, just because of his upbringing in Brooklyn and in D.C., he himself has said that, like, he grew up as the only white kid in a D.C., in a historically black D.C. neighborhood for a long part of his life. And he said that all his friends were black. And he said, this is quoting him, the girls who sat on my lap were black, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like he feels, you get the feeling that he feels he's, like, talking from personal space when he talks about these things, but sometimes it's lost. Like he knows dirty streets inside out. He's obsessed with it. It's prevalent throughout his work. I would say he is an expert on dirty gutters and rundown streets and stuff like that, just how he was raised. But when it comes to that other stuff, it's sort of ham-fisted. And I kind of wonder, I don't know this for a fact, but I kind of wonder if Crumb wasn't mad at him not just because of like the variations between the comic and what ended up on the movie, but because you can kind of tell, as much as like I like Bakshi and stuff, you can kind of tell that the counterculture wasn't actually his scene, because a lot of the quote-unquote hippies are basically like very tired caricatures of what everyone in the pop culture, at the, you know, because this is the early 70s, so like the height of the Haight-Ashbury and all that stuff had passed. And so hippies were like this kind of short form for anyone that was like outside the norm. And so it became like this like caricature of a hippie.
I think that is where Crumb kind of separated from this too, was there was that idea that the target of this movie is liberals, and the, or someone could watch it today and say snowflakes and woke culture. And that really, I don't get the impression that that was really necessarily Crumb's target in the original comics or in general. Not that he really related as much to the counterculture or that much more, it seems, than Bakshi did. But that really was the clearest thing that I got from this movie, is that he's learning that these radicals and revolutionaries just want to hurt and destroy and aren't really living out their ideals of love. And that's kind of an interesting place for this, you know, profane movie with all kinds of like animal fucking in it to land.
Well, I wonder though, if Bakshi didn't see that for what it is, because the more and more I learn about starting with the Beats, like Beat Generation, and then on through like, you know, the counterculture and the hippie movement and all that stuff, the more I realize that most of it was, I mean, at its core, there were some people who were really genuinely interested in changing the culture or elevating people. But a lot of the people that got in it were just misogynists trying to use it for personal gains and stuff like that, you know? So I wonder if Bakshi didn't see that for what it is. Because, I mean, like the scene in the park, so Fritz and his friends are, you know, meeting up to play instruments together, but it doesn't really seem like it's about them getting to play together, because they see this trio of attractive looking you know, female animals coming towards them, and they quickly start to play their hearts out, I mean to the point of exhaustion, but the girls ignore them. And so they very quickly, I mean, Fritz especially quickly ditches the music, and he's no longer a musician. He stops because it didn't work. And then he turns to what it seems like the girls were interested in, which was, you know, social issues and the downtrodden blacks, according to them, you know.
He lures them with like a poetic speech.
Yeah, about his woes.
He just starts like kind of speaking babble, and they're like, what is he saying? And then he like leads them into this whole,
yeah, which is also right out of the comic too. That was, yeah, but it's and I, that does, I feel like, kind of highlight where some of these people were charlatans who were just pretending to care about some of this stuff to get people in bed or, yes, to experience the drugs and the sex, you know.
That's part of why the Fritz, the character in the movie at least, isn't, I never quite got a handle on him, in that sometimes it seems like the joke was him, that he was just exploiting all of this stuff to get laid. Sometimes it seems like he was being genuine and righteous about it, or he ends up like inciting this riot basically. And I don't know. I didn't find him to be that coherent of a character, which I think kind of leads the, but I also don't find a lot of just the movie, either narratively or thematically, to be that coherent, because, you know, he throws out a lot of stuff out there. We get, you know, drugs and orgies, and we get this like Nazi rabbit who rides around on a motorcycle. And that's clearly not, you know, supposed to be bad. But we also get the pigs, who are, you know, these idiots that they're always making fun of and getting into scrapes. There's even this scene in a synagogue where, you know, there's a whole bunch of, I'm not sure what kind of animals they're supposed to be, but they're just some kind of anthropomorphized animals meant to be like a bunch of rabbis or a congregation. And it doesn't really do a lot with that. Like they do hear something over the radio about Israel getting arms from the U.S. And so they all break into this celebratory dance, and the scene just kind of ends there. And I feel like he does a lot of stuff like that where he's throwing out a lot of incendiary, you know, images and different things that could signify a lot of different things, but they don't really come together. And I wonder how much fundamentally that Bakshi is like a writer as opposed to just an animator or a guy who has all these great visual ideas, and, you know, him animating documentary recordings and stuff allows him to just come up with these devices for portraying like a setting and an atmosphere. But I do wonder between all of these movies, you know, how much of a grasp he really has on things as a writer.
Honestly, I just think the man is a fan of vignettes and skits. Like, he really wants to throw those in. He really does throughout all his other movies. I mean, Cool World, not to go on a little tangent, but in Cool World, there's several little tiny scenes where they has nothing to do with anything, but he just needed to get this idea out that was loosely based in what's going on, but not really. And were you to cut it out, it wouldn't do anything to the story or the narrative or whatever, but it definitely would take some flavor out. So I actually do like those. And there's several Jewish or Jewish adjacent like little scenes throughout his movies and stuff. I think he's just throwing in parts of his life.
I'd say that the like kind of fragmented feeling works for Fritz the Cat and works for me a lot of the time. Fritz the Cat is comic strips first and foremost. They are like four panels at a time. So in a way, there's something kind of true to the original source material in that respect. That they are just sort of these little vignettes and things like that. Sometimes just like moving single panels of just like there's a beat and then there's another beat and there's the joke kind of thing.
He might just not, be as much of a big picture guy as a lot of feature length directors are, where I could see him really going, excelling in like maybe a shorter format, because I don't know. I think this movie might get a little too much like credit as satire, because especially for like an 80-minute, you know, satirical film, I think requires a little bit more of like a focus on what exactly the target is, which I don't think he has a great grasp on that. And or at least it didn't really come through to me, except for the shots, you know, that are the most obvious where he's, you know, telling them that they're he's going against somebody who's going to blow up a power plant, or it's making fun of these liberals. And so it did, that element did seem kind of scattered to me. Like it does seem like he was just too enthusiastic about throwing in all of his ideas. And that's why I enjoyed this mostly on a visual level more than I even expected to. Cause there is a lot of really cool animation in this, from like the drug freak out they have and all these kind of like just driving around through these abstract like cityscapes and highways and a desert. There's this really cool like transition where there's just a crow that's just like dancing for a long time while this slow zoom happens.
Oh, I love that one with the psychedelic colors on him.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And they just slowly zoom in on this little box that becomes like the main picture that we're looking at.
Yeah. That's the color wheel spinning. Yeah.
And when I could just kind of groove on that visual stuff, that helped like capture my, you know, imagination, I guess.
Groove on it, Marky baby. Groove on it.
I was grooving on it. I lit a J.
Yeah, heavy.
I feel like Bakshi's the king of that stuff. Like, there's a scene, I don't know if you remember, but it's a tiny scene. It's just a little beat after Fritz, spoiler alert, Fritz gets blown up trying to help out the weird cultists or whatever, blow up a power plant. He himself is blown up. And there's just a still scene of a desert with like a big cactus. And it goes from like just the blood red from the explosion back to a real like dusk scene, you know? And that just really sets it. And his movies are full of stuff like that, like whether it was, again, a cost cutting measure or just some sort of flavor, it really adds to it. I love that kind of stuff. Like the dancing crow and things like that. It's so good.
Yeah, I think my favorite sequence actually was when the people in the city and the cops or whoever are having this bloody battle with each other, and this crow is killed, is like shot to death and has this long, slow, bloody death that's kind of visualized with like pool balls, like rolling into these red holes.
Yeah, because he was a pool shark. Yeah.
Yeah, because he's a pool shark. And so each heartbeat as it slows down is one more ball going into the hole. And then the last one hits and his heart stops. And then it turns into a bloodshot eye, which is amazing. I feel that if he hadn't handled some of these deaths, because some of them are pretty gruesome and pretty, you know, definitely, if anything would tell you this is not for children, is some of the way that some of these animals die. But if things like that really help to kind of ease the edge, like take some of the edge off. I mean, because you have these scenes where, like, again, like the pool balls and stuff are artistically timed to his fading heartbeat. But then in the next scene, he's lying face down with his ribs exposed in the back. You know, he just Bakshi's all over the place. That's what I love about
all. Over the place.
All over.
Yeah, there is some violence that's just disturbing in this and almost pointless. Like when this hillbilly dog like pulls over his car and just beats the chickens in the back of his truck to death.
Oh my God.
There's like no punchline.
Yeah. No, it's just mean.
Later on, he's with this like lizard revolutionary and the Nazi rabbit has this like either a horse or a hippo lady who's chasing them around all the time. And he just like beats the shit out of her.
A horse, I think.
And it's this long thing too, which again was like, doesn't seem to be really making much of a point with this or anything, but it just, you know, made me feel like gross.
Yeah. It's just pushing buttons for sure. A lot of the time. And some of them open certain doors that are interesting. And some of them are just like textural, like, weird feelings all of a sudden. No, thank you.
I think he has this compulsion where he just is like, I gotta talk about this. I gotta talk about it. That's my back. I gotta talk about it. But for as much as people would say that he's like doing commentary with these films, and he might be, he's doing commentary with like a hammer. It's very ham-fisted.
Well, I think him and Crumb are both in the tradition of something like Looney Tunes or funny animal comics where it is... It's literally borrowing from that and just like being very true to that anarchy tradition of Bugs Bunny that is like, regardless of like, maybe they're making fun of politicians at the time or like celebrities of the time or something like that. But it's always got to have like, it's all about the anvil still at the end of the day. It's all about the anvil being dropped and you you like watching the anvil like smash this thing, you know? And it's wild to expand it into like trying to do something so silly and childish while also trying to make comments about civil rights.
It's an uneasy marriage of those two elements for sure. And I think that shock value is something that is fundamental to his sensibility. So, you know, you do need to find things amusing like all of the tits and the sex and the penises. And all of these, you know, him having sex with this crow and her laughing at him having a small dick that isn't, you know, black enough for her, basically. And
her words,
I think the biggest thing or negative thing that I say about my experience with the movie is that this is, you know, ostensibly a comedy. And I'm not sure I laughed more than once, really. I don't necessarily align, I guess, comedically with it. I just didn't find it terribly funny. And there's a lot of energy to it. And I enjoyed a lot of the visual things. But in the comedy, I was mainly just kind of sitting there the whole time. And just like, maybe if I was like 13.
Well, yeah. I think the way I was exposed to it, it was pre-internet. And, you know, you had to have someone who had a tape. Who could tape it for you or copy it or whatever. And so when you don't have all this context and it's just these animals doing things you've never seen a cartoon do, then yeah, it can be a laugh riot. But transpose that experience, like the blaxploitation early 70s, grindhouse, you know, gritty New York, which most of us have never experienced because we're not old enough to experience gritty New York. It probably hit a lot different for those folks, especially in New York. And it probably was like a laugh riot to them. But transpose that to us and everything that we've seen and we've been exposed to, it's just, it can be uncomfortable. It's like you said, it's like a hard marriage, those kind of messages with like, oh, here's some titties and, you know, here's dick and here's like a quasi-racist vignette. It's a lot. Bakshi is all over the place.
And that does seem like a very Crumb thing, too. There's lots of, like, gigantic breasts and even gigantic women with little men with just starry-eyed horny chasing them around.
It's extremely horny.
And just everything I know about Crumb is, like, that's his thing, like, to a T. So I was interested to see, you know, his other movies after this to see when he was just 100% Bakshi, like, how much of that stuff held over and how much of it was Crumb wanting to ride a giant horsewoman around.
They're both pretty horny, yeah.
Yeah. You're both pretty horny repressed guys, for sure.
So I want to kind of wrap this up with just getting your guys' final thoughts about the movie overall. And, of course, we do want to answer whether we would or would not unwatch this film if we had the opportunity to. But also just a chance to throw in any kind of final thoughts you wanted to say about Fritz the Cat.
I still really like this movie. I was really surprised how much I enjoyed this movie this time. I think like the first time I saw this, I was like the first time I was really like figuring out how to be a leftist or figuring out about like identity politics and racial issues. So to suddenly be thrust like back into history was just like too much for me to handle. And it was like very easy for me from my like 20 whatever high horse to like look at Fritz the Cat and Coonskin as well, just to spoil a little bit of the next movie we're talking about, to just kind of dismiss this as like, well, he has not read this article and that article and all that and stuff like that, which is just, I don't know. It's easy to do a lot of that with older cinema. But yeah, Fritz is wild. It's a trip, man. It's a trip.
Seth was high as hell when he watched it.
Yeah, you gotta be. And last thing I'll say is I love this little scene where the atomic bomb is going off, I think. And it's just a random silhouette of Mickey Mouse and like Donald Duck.
Yeah.
And they're like waving American flags. Oh, right. It's like 2 seconds, but he had to throw it in there. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah. A little fuck you to Disney.
So no unwatch from you?
No way.
All right. Yeah, and I want Jared to have the final word here, so I'll just say real quick.
Oh, thank you.
I would not unwatch it either. I kind of just ended up in the middle with it as far as finding it a lot more visually interesting than I was expecting, and even for it to be bringing up the commentary as scattered as it is, you know, revealed it to be not just about the, you know, the sex and the button pushing and being naughty and giggling, basically. Although that still does pretty much dominate for me. And if I had found it funnier, that probably would have gone a long way further to it. But basically, I found a lot more to appreciate than I was expecting going in, that it's not as simple to nail it down as it might seem at first.
Definitely wouldn't unwatch this. I was fortunate or unfortunate, depending on your point of view, to have watched this at a time when I had no context. Where I knew nothing about what it was referencing or anything like that. At an age pre-internet, where it was just super cool and something you knew you probably shouldn't be watching and you knew was like quote unquote bad, but it was just cool because these animals were, you could see animal boobs and then people were like cussing and people were dying and stuff like that, which was. At the time, like when I saw it in the early 90s, you had never seen this. There was no way to see anything like that, especially where I grew up. So I was conditioned growing up with all sorts of different animation to be primed for something like this. So when it hit me the first time I watched it, it really blew my like 13, 14-year-old mind. Then on repeated viewings, as you get older and you have more context, then it is sort of like you can see where, like Seth said, that it kind of does get in the way of just enjoyment of what it is as what it is, but still definitely not would unwatch it. And I see it for its merit. But I also feel like I can enjoy it because I know all the places where he's coming from. And so it, with that context, it maybe takes some of the edge off. But if you had no idea what you're about to get into, it could, I could see definitely being very offensive, very off-putting and stuff like that. So I could see it from everyone's point of view, but no, I definitely would not unwatch it. I'll watch it again.
Well, yeah, all that stuff that you said, especially about knowing where it's coming from, I think it applies three times over for the next movie.
Yeah. My big thing with Coonskin, it feels like, I think it was Jared who said it's very much about the 70s in New York, like, and like for that crowd, like specifically, like almost like it was made to speak to that crowd, like for that crowd.
For the midnight movie Dolomite crowd, take a person off of the street of 2022 and make them watch Coonskin and it'd be turned off within the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, I feel like this movie doesn't really wear its intent like on its sleeve. It throws out a lot of loaded imagery and deliberately offensive, grotesque caricatures of every single person and kind of person that's in it. And again, you still have some of that sloppiness that will give people room to be uncomfortable with it in legitimate ways. But just so anyone knows what we're talking about, this was, he did one movie in between. He did Heavy Traffic, I think, after Fritz, and then did Coonskin.
Yes, which is like basically like Coonskin light.
Almost. Yeah, that's what it sounded like.
If you want to call it light at all, it's still like this whole psychedelic journey through New York and like through various stereotypes of various New York groups and things like that. But it's not at the level of Coonskin, which is very specifically aimed at the African-American issues, which is, I mean, I think what is always going to make it maybe Bakshi's most controversial movie. Maybe one of the most controversial animation flicks I've ever seen, yeah.
For sure. It was actually, I watched this on the Criterion channel, which just goes to show like that they are considering it to be like of historical interest, you know, that this was one of the most controversial films, certainly animated films, although it did get an R rating, unlike Fritz, which kind of surprised me.
Wow. There's dicks all over this thing. Yeah. There's tits all over this thing. And like racial slurs and the F word. I don't understand the difference, really, to be honest.
Me neither. And I don't know, specifically what this is kind of trading in is these Uncle Remus folk tales that was, even themselves were problematic because these were based on actual folk tales that slaves and freemen in the South had actually been talking about or, you know, passing down, but they were told and repackaged basically as these books around this Uncle Remus character written by a white guy who grew up like on the plantations and became very successful with, you know, selling these and using dialect in them. And they had these archetypes in them, which we see reproduced here, such as a Brother Rabbit, which is kind of this trickster character who's always getting into scuffles with these schemes of Brother Fox and Brother Bear. And we see these represented in kind of a slightly different context here in this movie, where they have kind of the same personalities, but they're blown up into having this adventure in Harlem where they're taking over the underworld and fighting against the Italian mobsters and the cops. And it is deliberately using this iconography that is racist, based in minstrel shows, even describing some of it is just like, you know, some of them are animals. Sometimes they're just these weird inhuman looking black things with like giant lips. And It's not just black people, it's queer people, Italians, we get some Jewish people in there, Southerners. They're all the most grotesque caricatures that you could possibly imagine. And
it's ruthless.
You know, whether he has a totally solid grasp on what he's doing with all of that is a question. But it is interesting that this is, you know, these Uncle Remus folk tales were appropriated in the first place by white people on behalf of black people. And in a way, you could say Bakshi's doing that here. He is the white guy who is trading in all of this stuff, and you're hoping that he has a good grasp on it and a point that he's making. But I don't know where you guys land with that.
I mean, at least to touch on the whole Br'er Rabbit thing, I think just as a jump-off point, I think it is
like all of Bakshi's stuff, it's going to keep on coming up no matter which movie you're talking about. It's inconsistent. It starts and stops and it doesn't meet up. But I think what a lot of is going on here is weaponizing and repurposing of stereotypes and of a myth like Br'er Rabbit. Like the whole thing is Br'er Rabbit is like they're threatening to throw him into the briar patch in the story. And they're like, we're going to do it. You're going to throw you in the briar patch. And he's like, please, please don't throw me in the briar patch. And the whole thing is he's saying that because like, it's actually not a bad thing. He's not afraid of the briar patch. And then in this one, there's like a whole sequence and we'll get into like the actual plot. But the version of that story in this is where they threaten to throw him in like the streets into the garbage or something like that. And his Br'er Rabbit is like, ah, don't throw me into the streets. Don't throw me, you know, I don't throw me out there, you know, and they do it. And the whole thing is like, then he's like, fuck you. I was born in the streets. It strikes me as empowering at that point, because it is like he knows that a lot of the audience is going to be white going to this movie, and he knows it's going to make them like have to kind of reconcile with this and look at this and look at what has been done. And a lot of the characters you are faced with that there are these like stereotypes in the movie, they are like owning it and weaponizing, like saying that, like, yeah, I am that and I'm going to use that. Like, I don't know. It's intense and it's complicated for sure.
I know from interviews and things he said that his intent was to kind of show, he wanted to hold up a mirror to America and be like, this is who you think they are. And this is who you have created. This is your creation. You have created this. If you think this is offensive, or if you think that this like doesn't hold up well, it's because you made it. The minstrel shows were purely not completely a product of white America, but they were commodified and then made into a cash machine for white America, and then became a prevalent image of black people and stuff like that. And so he seems to genuinely be trying to hold a mirror up. However, even though he was, you know, raised in impoverished neighborhoods, and he does have that perspective, and he was raised by black neighborhoods and black culture, it still sort of smacks of like, I am a world-weary white man, and I'm showing you this because I understand them. So sometimes it lands, most times it doesn't, I feel. Or again, we go back to the Bakshi ham fist, where he's got these notions that he wants to lay out, but just the execution is so ham-fisted sometimes. Like, it's like, again, to go back to what we've said so many times, it's just all over the place. Sometimes it's gorgeous. Sometimes it's beautiful. Sometimes it's poignant. Sometimes it's just like he just wanted to throw that in there because he thought it was cool and he wanted to throw in it. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, but there's, I mean, there's just some beautiful, like the intro shot. To go back to the beginning shot with Scatman Crothers singing that song, the way it's framed.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. The way the titles come in and stuff like, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But then bookending the movie with the live action, almost like Song of the South, you know, kind of thing going on.
Yeah, talk about fuck you, Disney. This is like,
yeah,
definitely not letting Disney get away with having made that movie and remakes
with it. Song of the South. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it, really, that his intent here is not, this is not a racist provocation. And when this did, just like Fritz the Cat was initially dropped by Warner Brothers and had to get picked up by a new distributor, this also got dropped. And the Congress of Racial Equality very like high profile-y picketed this movie and accused it of being racist. Admittedly, a lot of them had not had an opportunity to see the movie when they started with these protests, but that is where a lot of the controversy came from. And I think it's clear that he's not using this as a way to, like, you know, condone these stereotypes or to be using it in a racist way. But it all does come back to, regardless of his intent, he doesn't, you know, he's eager to present this stuff and again, kind of provoke and rub your faces in it without quite taking the extra step of subverting the things, this caricatures that we're seeing, or really feeling like he has a good handle on it. And then at the same time, just like Jared was saying, there's visually, this is even, I haven't seen any Bakshi besides this Fritz and his Lord of the Rings movie, but it seems like he's at like just a peak of his visual imagination all throughout this, starting with this. The most surprising thing to me is the first like 10 minutes of this movie is live action and there's no animation at all. It's like this framing story that has two guys who are breaking out of prison waiting for a car to come pick them up. And we have
Barry White.
We got Barry White. We got Scatman Crothers from The Shining and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
We got Tubbs from Miami Vice.
Yeah, from Miami Vice. And they also do then the voices of these cartoon characters, which is a story basically within the story that Scatman Crothers is telling the guy he's escaping with. And yeah, it's interesting because it adds this flavor to it and it's a great intro with the credits. Although I'm not sure what the whole framing story really is like doing there. Like what the point of it is besides just to be a framing story, unless I'm missing some connection here.
Isn't that what the framing story frames stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. It doesn't seem to like connect with it or anything.
Well, I think it was mostly like we have to. So it's like, why do we have to wait and sit and listen to this story? Well, let's do something that, you know, 70s blaxploitation audience will know, which is either a prison escape or some sort of prison scene or something like that. So while we have to wait for whatever, you know, life is going to let us move on to, whether it's going to let us escape or whether it's going to kill us, we got some time. Let me tell you some stories because that's all we can do right now. But to frame the stories like that, it kind of puts it as like, this is what you're going to go through. This is what we're going through, or this is the aspirations you can, this is what you can aspire to once you make it free past this, you know, field.
That's a good way of putting it. And I do think that's one of the interesting aspects of this movie that I think yet another thing that makes it kind of in a league of its own, like, and sometimes for good and bad reasons, but like it's a movie that is still trying very much to entertain in just like a very like having a good time at the movies kind of way, as much as it is like assaulting you with all these like confusing, complicated images and political statements. It still like at the same time wants to have like shootouts and boxing matches and like exciting crime aspects and stuff like that, which is, I think it's just doing so many things. It's just doing so many things at once. I think that's really interesting, which you just do not get now. If it's an issue movie, if it's a piece about issues, it has to be like so very serious, so very about those issues. And it has to like have such a like, I have the answers and have it all like figured out kind of, because we have, there's so much fear now of doing it wrong, where in Bakshi's era there was no, they didn't even know how to do it right, how to make a movie like this right, like a satirical complicated political cartoon movie like this properly. So he did just kind of go into it like, I think it was Jared saying that it was very much, it's coming from his perspective, and you can kind of see that it's very specifically 70s New York and what Bakshi knows about it. And I don't think he would argue with you if you called him out on things about it. I don't know, like called him out on like not getting the full grasp of that issue or this issue or something like that. But he's, you know, using his platform and he's allowed to kind of do that. And I think artists should be allowed to kind of try things and try to like go into issues that are difficult and try and explore them. It's surprising that a white artist would want to suddenly, like, he has a platform and he uses it kind of specifically for black issues. And again, like, your mileage may vary in various sequences as to how well he does with it. Like, he fails dramatically in a lot of ways, but it's kind of wild that he went out and tried to do this at all.
I feel throughout the film that it feels like it is a story about a Black experience from the outside in. Like, it definitely doesn't feel like it's, as much as it's like Black narrators and Black cast and Black animators, which was great at the time. Disney, he beat Disney to it. I mean, Disney had like one or two, and this cast was a bunch of Black animators. But,
and that's a problem. It needs more like Black voice in it, and that is like always going to be like a problem with this movie, is that it doesn't have a Black person at the helm, like, as, or like at least more of a touch there.
Yeah, it definitely does feel like this is the Black experience that I experienced as a white man living in a Black neighborhood. This is like, well, he trying to boil down the essence to what he saw, and which is wild, because you would think that, like, I mean, there's even times where it's just like you have a very minstrelly and I don't know if this was on purpose, but there is a scene where there's a minstrel type character who is very, very minstrelly, very, very grotesque animated character in front of a scene of real life bar, or maybe it's a bar or a barbershop or some sort of like establishment. And it's just these young Black men, and they're just, you know, having fun and talking and laughing, and just seem very, you know, chill, and they're just hanging out, and none of them are grotesque characters. They just seem like normal dudes hanging out, and it is just this image of this, like, again, this grotesque character in front of them dancing, and then they're all just having fun. And so actually, when I saw that today, I was like, did he not see this? Could he not have also shown some of this without that? Like, I don't know. It's hard, but visually it's,
yeah.
Yeah. And who this is for is definitely a big question too. Cause is he sticking it to the racist by shoving the images back in their face, or they're just trying to make you think about it? Obviously, if this, you know, if you were a Black person in the 70s watching these and were familiar with all of these, you know, stereotypes and the history behind them, I'm not really sure what that person would get out of this movie. It is kind of muddy like that. And
of course,
I do. You mentioned the like live action, you know, backgrounds, which are used pretty extensively here. Sometimes even with people, there's a scene where there's a few scenes that have actual people like talking to the animated characters. So you do have this weird kind of documentary element almost to it. There's like this video of this guy playing a trumpet in the middle of the street that it keeps going back to.
Yeah, when they say Harlem, and then all of a sudden there's like this trumpeter in the middle of the street, and it's so cool.
Yeah, and it's like they almost accidentally end up pulling out some poignant things because he's so willing to just throw at, you know, anything that comes into his mind out there. And every once in a while, it does result in something like, there, I'm thinking specifically of this sequence with this lady who's like sitting, I think, with her kids at a crib or something, and she's telling a story about what does she call him? Like Malcolm the cockroach is this guy that she had a relationship with, and then eventually a rat. And it's just her telling this story, and it's kind of sorrowful and seems genuine, and she keeps turning into like all red and blue and back and forth as she's telling it, while in the background we have this kind of red sketches of the cockroach. And I think that's probably my favorite part of the movie, because again, it seems kind of random, but it seems like we're actually getting like a real experience, and it's beautifully animated. And it does help add, you know, some kind of a layer there that there's more to this world than it just being all of this outrageousness.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this does strike you again as like, if he's falling on his face, it is quite often out of love. And I mean, of course, we can always be observing these layers of racism that anyone who is outside of a certain group has, all these unintentional aspects of racism that we like carry around. But like, at least what he wears on his sleeve, I do think it's out of a place of like genuine fascination and genuine like support of Black culture and Black issues.
Definitely. If you just look at those sequences with Miss America, with this big blonde busty, you know, Miss America lady.
Oh, I love those.
Who has, you know, the American flag on her.
Clad in the stars and stripes, yeah.
And she encounters the Black characters and she's seducing them and saying, yeah, come on over here, baby. I'm going to, you know, we're finally going to get together. And then she screams rape when they come near her or she kills them. And as far as looking for his intent, I mean, that's not exactly subtle as far as, you know, where he's coming from with the social commentary. So...
No, yeah. None of it's subtle.
Think about how pointed it is now to like to audiences now in 2022 that the Miss America, you know, American flag character, blonde, blue eyes, says rape. So like the second she says rape, there's not even a pause. A Black character approaches her at her beckon. She says rape the second he gets close to her. Without there even being a beat, a noose is dropped and he is executed. And then without missing another beat, she just goes right back to playing her guitar. So it's like, it's very, you know, on the nose and again, but it's crazy how that's just still the reality right now. Like weaponized white tears, weaponized white, like fear, it kills Black bodies. And it was happening then. It happens now. It's just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, so much of the movie are these layered, moving political cartoons, basically. Like, it is very, very vignette, very much so. Even though there is, like, the full trajectory of it is this mob battle movie where it's the, you know, Blacks versus the Italians and then ultimately, like, you know, battling the cops and all of that stuff, which, yeah, there's... But yeah, first and foremost, it is like these little vignette scenes, which even the opening, like before we get to Scatman Crothers, there's like a little quick vignette that starts off with, again, your first introduction to these very exaggerated, you know, kind of racial stereotype cartoons. I thought there was, it's already just like, pow, there it is. And it's like a frozen, like static Crothers. Shot for a second. I thought there was something wrong with this, with the screen, but like there's, it just comes up immediately and you're instantly thrust into just like, where am I? This is not something that, am I supposed to be seeing this? Is this okay? Like, it is so immediately crazy and intense and it does not stop. Which a lot of these things I couldn't help but compare him to like Quentin Tarantino too. Mm. As far as sort of like the good things and the bad things about like the hot water that Tarantino gets into by like it's really great that he's a white artist. He has like a big platform and he's talking about Black stories often and Black issues sometimes. But still it's going to be messy. It's going to be really messy, and I think some of the criticism is apt for him and Bakshi, right?
Yeah. Tarantino's another white guy who thinks he knows the Black experience enough to talk about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is without a hint of irony, but...
And there's kind of a line between, like, how much of it, this is, you know, just coming from the best possible place, and how much is a little bit like fetishizing the whole culture and everything about it.
Yeah. Which is the danger of being like supportive and being like a quote unquote like fan or aficionado or something like that. But you're still an outsider here. You just need to realize, and it's totally like what's to be expected. If like I do suddenly sit down and write some book about Portugal, having never been to Portugal, or like, you know, it's like I might like somehow like pull some stuff out of my ass or like research the hell out of it and like say some good things about it and like maybe some good points and everything. And but I should be expecting some pushback, and I better be like open to learning, right?
Exactly. You have a responsibility to be continually addressing your own blind spots that are just naturally there. If you're going to go there, then, you know, you have to realize the shortcomings that are coming along with it and just be continually willing to educate yourself if it's not something that comes completely naturally. And, you know, I want to make sure we talk about other characters in this movie. Like, we have this whole big sequence with Simple Savior, who is this reverend who is one of the most disgusting like images we see in this movie.
Oh, just yeah.
Giant, fat, naked reverend, I guess, who dances around. He's telling everybody to kill Whitey and that they should have a revolution.
See, Mark, I think you're being a little... I think he's beautiful.
Oh, all right. Well, I don't think that's the perspective of the film. But
Mark's canceled. That's it.
No.
And it turns out he's, you know, he just participates with the Italian Godfather and the cop, and it's all a money making scheme. Yeah. So we're supposed to view him as this detestable character.
Yeah, he's not disgusting because he's fat. He's disgusting because he's a piece of shit.
He is. He's so awesome, though. He, like, gets crucified. He's, like, naked.
The movie's definitely using his physical appearance in order to make him seem like a bad guy.
Yeah.
It's true. I was taking a low blow at you.
Yeah. Well, much as the way it does these, if you get offended at Italian stereotypes, watch out. Because,
oh, Lord.
My God, the Godfather character in this, and he's got this little Mario the Clown who's always with these outrageous Italian accents. That are the villains for sure.
Yeah. I think the grossest caricature, I mean, besides the super offensive racist caricatures of black folks, but the Godfather is just grotesque. I mean, the way he really digs into the pockmarks on his face, like he's they seem like they go on for miles, you know, and his teeth and it's all so gross.
It's Grandpa from the Munsters, right? Voicing him?
It is Grandpa from the Monsters. Yeah, I was so shocked to see that. And there's like a lot of weird like little cameos. Like just real quick to go back to Fritz, the Black Crow lady, the older lady who Fritz, you know, ends up having sex with, but she laughs at his small cat penis. That's the grandma from the Urkel show. From what's it called? Family Matters. So the grandma on that show was Fritz the cat, which I think is wonderful. Did you see the mafia guy has some sons?
They're like gay trans cowboys, like.
But one of them talks like John Wayne for some reason.
Yeah, that seemed like one of those ideas that he's just like, I don't know, the sight of this gay cross dressing guy speaking like John Wayne. Clearly, we're doing something there with masculinity, and maybe they're making fun of John Wayne. It just seems like an idea that he has, like, well, the rest will take care of itself. It seems like there's probably something going on there, but there are a lot of mincing gay caricatures in this movie as well, which, yeah, I guess it's equal opportunity in that sense that everybody is like that, so it's not necessarily like they're being targeted, but I guess where you could say, like, well, he's meaning for this to be empowering and reappropriating in a certain way. It doesn't feel that way for me for any of the other caricatures as far as what you could even make an argument about. Like, these really are just perverts who are disgusting.
For sure.
There was one scene, though, that I did root for. I was on the side of one of the gross characters, the Simple Savior character. When he's doing his little stage show, you know, to the stage show that the Simple Savior does is very, like, very theatrical and giving the congregation like these theatrics of Kill Whitey and whatever, which is in contrast to the beginning live action, sermon given by a preacher man, who is, you know, Brer Fox in the animation, but in live action, he's a preacher. And he's just basically doing this very heartfelt call out to God, like, hey, I help you. Why aren't you helping me? And then you switch to Simple Saviors, which is like, hey, it's all Whitey's fault. Let's go get Whitey. But there is a part where he's on a cross and he pulls out these two guns and these real life posters of John Wayne, Elvis, and Nixon pop down. Like, they're like actual photos of them, not animation. And he just shoots the shit out of them. And I was like, yeah, Elvis was a hero to most, it's but he so never cool. meant shit to me. He's straight up racist. That sucker was sitting on a plane. Motherfucking man, John Wayne. Wayne.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Fuck him and John Wayne.
Yeah. But then at the same time, it's this like, the guy who's doing it is this hypocrite who's inciting violence and using the money to benefit himself. So himself, it's just yeah. another thing where the more you dissect it, the more confusing it gets as far as this could be something that could be used just to be like a criticism of, you know, people who use that kind of rhetoric. And it does feel like he's just kind of throwing it all out there.
But that's why I like Brer Rabbit. Like, they do kind of stay in the same spirit of the Uncle Remus, Brer Rabbit for Brother Rabbit, because he immediately sees how fucking bullshit this is. And with, what, 7 words, he takes down their entire operation by basically getting the congregation to question why they're giving all this money. Like, oh, yeah, we've got tanks, we've got guns, we're almost there. We're almost have enough money to go after Whitey. And then so Brer Rabbit is like, oh, okay, well, I guess you don't need any more money if you have it all. Like, let's go. Let's go right now. I'm ready. And then they start being like, well, no, we're almost there. We're almost there. And then that gets the congregation to start to turn, which starts Simple Savior, like, going after him and stuff. I thought that was pretty cool that that they used his, like, his cleverness to point out, like, that those kind of churches don't give a shit about their congregation.
Yeah, I think the messiness is realistic in that it's the battle's never over. It's just like the setting is changing. It's constantly moving. Like our battles with these things, and it's never quite complete. It's just like once we get through one layer, then there's another layer of problems, right?
Well, yeah, then we're getting to the Italians and the gay people, and everyone's got their own, you know, role in this.
The gross cop who won't even shower when he's dealing with. Yeah.
Yes. We got a cop too, who's put in like blackface and panties and heels as a way to, like, you know, humiliate him and then lead to him getting killed by the cops. Really, I think from that point on, it's a pretty straightforward, like, it's just the, you know, them versus the bad guys until they finally overcome them in the end.
With the tar baby.
With, yeah, a tar rabbit.
With the Uncle Remus tar baby, the famous tar baby.
Yes. So, yeah, this was another case where I was, what kept me from disengaging too much was that there are so many visual things going on here. And this like nightmarish boxing montage that's at the end, that's like live action, was also really like this really powerful kind of, at least just viscerally striking sequence.
Absolutely.
Did you feel it was kind of Lynch-like? It was like,
yeah,
kind of like dreamlike almost, that big white room, not even a ring. And you're seeing it from the perspective of the boxer who's knocking out these live action boxers, Brother Bear, and just the reaction to his hits. You just like feel it.
The live action is very interesting in how it's used, and that, like, it would be very easy just to, like, be like, it's going to be wild. There's going to be live action and cartoons. But the live action, whoever is, like, doing a lot of that, there's a lot of style to it. It's not just, like, filming shit. It's a lot of, like, there's, like, weird first-person stuff. There's weird, like, slow-motion stuff going on a lot of the time, a lot of effects.
It makes me wonder, like, what, you know, a full live-action movie directed by Ralph Bakshi would look like, because all the live-action parts in this are very well shot and constructed.
There is one. Apparently, it sucks real bad.
Uh-oh.
Oh, wait, what is it? I don't know it.
I forget what it's called, but it's some... Oh. You know, it's got cars and guns and, you know, I don't know.
Geez, I got to find this. But yeah, Cool World, I feel like, is his most live action-y thing that I know.
That's like his Roger Rabbit, right? Like Brad Pitt is running around with the cartoon characters.
Yeah, which is funny that we say Roger Rabbit as a shorthand. I mean, I fucking adore Roger Rabbit. It's one of my top 10 films probably, but it's funny that we say that as shorthand because Bakshi did it before Roger Rabbit. We should
be saying, right.
We should be saying sure. Coonskin. We should be saying Fritz. Visually, some of the stuff in this movie that I love the most is like Brer Rabbit and Brother Fox or Brother Bear just walking down the streets of Harlem, but it's like live action Harlem. Mm.
It looks so cool.
It looks so cool. It really adds to it. I imagine those same scenes and the weight of feeling the intensity. Because like Brother Rabbit always has this intense look when he's like just looking straight ahead, and you could just tell that like he is in charge and no nonsense. And imagine if he was walking like that towards the camera in front of an animated background. I don't think it would have as much weight or punch. It wouldn't feel right.
This is a much trickier one than Fritz the Cat, so I want to give everyone a chance to kind of wrap up your thoughts for this one, too. I'll just start out by saying that I wouldn't unwatch this, and again, I was surprised by how much visual imagination there was, and that there are things to appreciate on that level, and even on this documentary level, of you do have all of these black actors working on this movie, and this actual footage from Harlem. But I do think that as far as social commentary, this is even less coherent than Fritz the Cat as far as how it all comes together. I really just don't think it does. And he is playing with fire, which makes it a little more uncomfortable. And I also just didn't find it funny either, which I know, I mean, Seth was saying a little bit like about how this does seem like a movie that wants to entertain or, you know, get some kind of dark comedy out of things also. So with those things, it really does make the whole thing kind of a mess to me.
Oh, there's no laugh out loud. It's all so dark that it's just not
exactly.
I don't know. Yeah, nobody is laughing at any of the jokes because it is like watching people getting hung. Like it's like as the punchline.
So it is a mess, but it is a surprisingly vital mess that's. I do think is not, it's the question is not, is this racist or not? Because he clearly isn't coming from that place. I don't think that he really knows, don't think he really knows what to do with all the stuff that he brings up, but it's not something that necessarily should just be dismissed out of hand for those reasons.
I think it is like no other movie out there. It is just nothing like this movie. Not even just from an animation standpoint, but just from a standpoint of the way the issues are tackled. There's very few movies that have this kind of like going out on a limb kind of way of approaching things that are like, yeah, like you said, it's playing with fire. It's absolutely playing with fire. But he's like laughing on the edge of that cliff, which is like an intoxicating energy to get caught up in. Maniacal laughter kind of shit. It's not trying to give us an answer, I don't think. And that's what I kind of appreciate about it. It's like a journalistic kind of approach, I feel like. It is just like a report from 1975 New York. And I appreciate art that is willing to go in there and get a little messy. I'm more interested in that. Because I think we need to not be afraid. And again, be ready. Like, because we should get in there and we should be able to have like a real conversation about it afterwards, rather than it being this thing where it's just like we're not allowed to like approach these things anymore unless you just like there's like this barrier for entry or something like that. It really takes some bravery, and it is messy. It has problems. It has a lot of problems for sure. It's got it like that's just seems to be like goes without saying with this like a movie about black culture by a Jewish guy. Yeah, of course, but. Yeah, there's a lot to this movie, and I think it's worthwhile to experience.
Yeah, nice dick too.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry,
I talked too long.
Tony, we'll cut that. We'll cut that out. Sorry. I was just staring at that button. These two are up to no good.
Oh, you're mad with power. But anyways,
yeah.
Yeah, all right, now you sorry. Got that yeah, button.
Jared, it's definitely your turn, Jared.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Seth said it all, really. I guess I wanted to add some stuff to what Seth had said, though, because while it does definitely feel like it is, it definitely does feel like journalistic and mostly reporting on an experience that he feels he has, as quasi-ignorant as he is on some of that stuff. It does really does genuinely feel like he is wholeheartedly reporting on what he says. But I never believed Bakshi to be a big picture kind of guy, you know, never. I never thought that he was like, oh, this will be my magnus opus where I have this very, very important thing to say and stuff like that. As a big picture, I think he just was hyper-focused on a very specific part of Black culture as he understood it, as he experienced it. Again, from the outside in, it is like a hyper-focused slice of what he experienced and an audience he was trying to reach and stuff like that, which, again, out of context, is just, you know, not good or right or whatever. But I have the benefit of age of like being closer to that. I mean, I'm not ancient, but like I am old enough to kind of see where you wouldn't have a modern audience's sensitivities or sensibilities, where it would be more like, oh yeah, this is what it was like. This is what really happened and stuff like that. And even though you now we know we have the benefit of being exposed to more things and knowing that it was way more nuanced than that. It was not that cut and dry. But I do feel that was not his intent. I don't think that he was trying to be the final voice in the Black experience. I think he was just trying to say, America, you're fucked up. This is who you are. This is who you say these people are, and look at it. Shame on you. And also look at these little cool vignettes I'm going to throw in because I have something to say, or they remind me of my childhood, or they remind me of like the neighborhoods I grew up in. I just want to say it. And I want to make sure I throw in as much tits and penises and stuff as I can too.
Cause I'm also a dirty old man. Jesus. Dirty, dirty old man.
I did want to take the opportunity to ask you too, as my, you know, white hosts, when you watch this, I mean, as a person of color watching this, I was uncomfortable at the beginning for sure. And also we Mexicans have a very complicated history of racism. There's a whole bunch of Bakshis in Mexico, especially in comics. One of Mexico's greatest comic heroes is a little Black boy who's a character. His name is Mamin Pinguin. And Mexican children, up until the 2000s, would read his stories. And it was like a horrible caricature. But I did want to ask, like, were you too uncomfortable at the beginning? And did that discomfort ever subside? Or was it just kind of in the background the whole time?
Well, yeah, it just ebbs and flows for me. It's just say the rug is constantly being pulled out from underneath me. Especially as like a white person who's like just trying, you know, act like very much on the outside, you know, like in my way. Also, like we've said before, is like the intent is constantly like being confused, which is also like a disorienting experience. But yeah, but I can't help but feel like it is like it's at least going in there with like some purpose a good portion of the time. But yeah, it's pretty damn uncomfortable, especially the first time I watched this. Like, absolutely, especially me as a white audience member, like, what do I do with this? Like, should I turn this off? Like, am I supposed to just like maybe this is, and also the like degrees of like it being sort of punishing like towards a white audience purposefully, which is also this thing that's just like, maybe like it's good that I'm like feeling so uncomfortable. It's like I need this punishment or something.
Like it's confronting you.
Yeah.
So then maybe it was doing its intent. Yeah.
Yeah. There was definitely a lot of discomfort. And I think a lot of it came from me just trying to figure out exactly where it was coming from and what it was trying to accomplish by bringing up all of these things. And every time that snapped into place for me, that was when it was least uncomfortable, like in the Miss America sequences, or even just like the framing story, which is just like a regular movie with nothing, you know, without much more than that going on. And so, yeah, when stuff snapped into focus like that was when I felt more like it was on the same page. Then there were other times where I was definitely thinking like, all right, do I have the volume like down low enough on this? am I the person like that should be sitting here having fun with this?
Your apartment complex is just full of a bunch of racist old ladies. So,
yeah.
Yeah. They're probably watching it too.
I watch this with full sound on with a sound bar. My wife was sitting in the living room watching her shows on her laptop with her headphones on. And I just kept looking over, waiting to see when she would turn around and be like, "What the fuck are you watching?" But she was pretty engrossed in what she was watching. But I do feel that there were certain times that she looked over and she just quickly looked back to the left of she was like, exactly. It's just so maybe mission accomplished, Bakshi. Like you made my wife uncomfortable for sure.
I mean, I felt pretty in touch with my own feelings about it, but there was still always a thing of like, I feel like I need the perspective of somebody who really knows about this kind of stuff to fill in that gap. And that person isn't me and it's not Bakshi. And that it does feel a little bit like I would really benefit from getting, you know, the perspective of somebody who is not a privileged white male like me and the maker of the film.
Well, okay. Thanks, everyone. I just wanted to know. I wanted to see what it was like for you.
But. Absolutely. Well, boy, yeah, we sure got into it, I think, with this these movies. I hope that we did them justice. And I want to thank Jared again for so much for helping bring that perspective here that I think we definitely needed for this. And do you have anything that you want to, you know, plug or throw out there when now that you have the ears of the entire nation?
No, nothing to plug. Be kind and gentle wherever you can. And I don't know. If you want to look at some weird stuff, go to Cosmotropics on Instagram.
Man, I love Jared. Fuck yeah, Jared.
I love you too.
It was our pleasure. And join us again next week for our second discussion of Coonskin. And maybe that then we'll finally yeah. get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, we're talking about Coonskin too.
All right. Well, thanks again. I think probably Tony will have found a spot to end around this point.
You guys don't do an outro or anything?
Tony usually figures it out. Yeah, you know, like some way of making it work.
Oh, so it's not like a sign off thing or whatever. Okay.
Who is he? Does he fuck you better?
Sorry.
Hey, before we go, can you give me one more of those? Just give me one more of those.
All right. Let me see if there's one that I haven't used yet. What's this?
Oh, lighten up, man. Come on.
I don't even know, like, who am I being in that?
I don't know. What?
Fingers going in those ladies' pussies.
Oh, my God. I am such an awful toilet mouth.
I really wouldn't listen to a podcast of just saying dumb shit.
That's what we just did for 2 hours.
I am a stupid bitch. I am a stupid bitch.
Again, I don't remember.
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.